You can support this podcast at patreon.com/partnersincrimemedia.
I'm Kevin Flynn with Rebecca Lavoie and John Cryer, and these are their stories.
You think you know who did it, but you don't know who did it. Law and order, law and order, law and order.
It's no ordinary police procedural, baby. It's the FNOG of police procedures, baby.
Law and order, law and order, law and order, law and order. These are their stories, these are their stories.
Welcome to These Are Their Stories, the podcast about network TV's most enduring crime drama and the real-life cases that inspired their shows. I'm Kevin Flynn. Each podcast will break down an episode from either Criminal Intent, SVU, or Original Recipe. You can see upcoming episodes by going to our website, lawandorderpodcast.com. Today, we'll be looking at Law & Order Prime, Season 1, Episodes 15 and 16, The Torrents of Greed, Parts 1 and 2. Now, joining me to do that is true crime author and host of the podcast Crime Writers On, my better half, Rebecca Lavoie. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, Kevin.
And rounding out the panel is our very special guest from Two and a Half Men, Pretty in Pink, and the Undisclosed Addendum podcast, Triple Threat, John Cryer.
Bum, bum. Oh.
I know we lost him for a second.
Bum, bum.
And musical
but I also
theater,
love the
genius.
Breakdown. I love the you know, come on. By the way, Rebecca, that your hello to Kevin, I think you should go back and listen to that again, because this is the most loaded hello, Kevin, I have ever heard. I don't know what was going on before.
She's
the
so mad about the laundry.
True fact. 100% true.
It's adorable.
You know, you're riffing there, but like we're looking at an episode of season one, which of course is way, way back.
You called it Prime. I would say this is like the book of Genesis, Law and Order, that you're talking about. It's like, it barely holds up. I feel like I should have been watching it like in an old-time movie theater with an organ player.
Well, there are so many things, and we'll talk about them, but so many things about season one that are different from the Law and Order we've come to know and love. And John, you were talking about the theme song.
Well, oh my gosh, the opening theme song, it luxuriates in itself. It is, it just goes on, and it has these wonderful photo montage of, you know, New York crime sort of moments, you know, and it just, you know, it's the law and it's the cops, and then it's order and it's the, you know, it's the DAs and such, but it goes in incredible depth. You know, it's a 14-hour miniseries of photos.
It was all this valuable network time that got wasted.
Yes. They could have been showing commercials at that time.
I think eventually they did.
Yes.
What really stuck out to me was the guitar riffing part of the theme song in this very, very old episode of Law & Order. That like, beer, 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 beer.
Like they're plucking the strings really hard.
They plucked the hell out of it. Like a person with long-ass fingernails. Like, beer, beer, beer. It was really, I would really recommend to our listeners who might have to go back and get this from Amazon or whatever, like, you really need to pay attention to the craziness of the theme song.
John, yes. You have a recurring role on NCIS, which is a TV procedural. It sounds like that you have sort of an open invitation to guest on SVU if you want.
No, I wouldn't put it that way. The thing was that the guy, Warren Light, who has produced SVU for the last few years, used to be my babysitter.
What?
I swear to God.
Rebecca just spit something out of her mouth.
he used to live a few floors up, and that wonderful play that he wrote was about his whole family, Sideman, that he wrote, and they were all a few floors upstairs from us. All that craziness was happening right up there. So we had a certain connection. However, he is no longer on the show, so I wouldn't assume that I am always welcome on the SVU.
But it sounds like, you know, at Law & Order, like the casting agent there is like the guy at Playboy who would call celebrities and want to know if they want to pose each month. It just seemed like there was a hit list, and so we got to get everybody.
Yeah, sooner or later, we're going to be on long enough that we will have gotten everybody.
And then you could be in one of those themed marathons on USA. Like last week, they had the sitcom stars marathon. It was riveting. It was Haley from Modern Family was on one, and then Haley's mom, Julie Bowen, was on the next one. And it was really, really incredible. And John could be on one of those if he's ever on this.
John, you rarely get to play the bad guy, it seems. Do you think it would be fun to do it? Because on SVU, obviously, you'd be a rapist or a killer or something.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you wouldn't just be embezzling. You would be doing something really bad.
they had talked to me about being a Ted Bundy-style serial killer, which sounds like fun, sure. but they kept emphasizing how handsome the guy had to be, which I was never comfortable with. That being said, yeah, I would love to. You know, I was just talking with Jim Clemente last week.
Name dropper. Go ahead. But keep
name
going.
Name drop. Yeah, keep I just going. That's how I roll. Welcome to Hollywood. And you know, he was saying they need serial killers on Criminal Minds. Thank you.
We need serial killers on Criminal Minds. Quick, round up some serial killers.
Send out a memo. some serial killers. So I'm sure at some point I'll be doing that, and you guys will be laughing your asses off.
Can't wait.
I know I might be scared.
I might actually end up watching really a show intense. I don't watch to see that. Yeah.
One time that I was really blown away was on Homicide: Life on the Streets. The guy who played Steve on Blue's Clues played a killer.
Yep.
And, you know, he was like really intense. And there were all these moms that were angry that Steve from Blue's Clues was a killer. It's like, put your kid to bed at 10 o'clock, for Christ's sake.
He's just an actor.
Yes. But he was, by the way, fantastic on Blue's Clues.
Yes. Yeah.
As an actor, you understand Blue is not really there.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty incredible. Side table doesn't really talk. There's not really a side table anywhere. He's interacting with things that don't exist.
That's right.
He's amazing.
You sound like a dad, of course.
I am a devout dad and devout fan of Blue's Clues
as
well.
Yeah, you got two kids and you've got a lovely wife and you've started this business called Discount Sushi, which is not a restaurant.
Thank God.
But it's your production company, right?
Yes, yes. When Two and a Half Men was over, Warner Brothers asked if I wanted to stay on and produce TV for them. And we were clearly hard-pressed for a name for a company.
Oh, I think it's a great name. Now, this is, you know, one of the biggest ensembles. I mean, it's been on multiple franchises that are these ensembles. And, John, you know better than most that a major cast change can sink a successful series if not handled right.
Yes.
So what do you think it is?
You got to say trigger warning, dude.
Yeah, trigger warning, sorry.
Say something like that. Because I cannot handle that.
Go to your happy place.
Okay.
Go to your happy place. Show us on the doll where the bad actor touched you. But what, John, what do you think it is about Law and Order that it went on for 20 years and SVU is going on its 18th year with so many moving parts and they're still able to deliver the goods? Why is that?
Fantastic formula. The original, the mothership Law and Order was a beautiful creation of a formula. They set it up. You know, you get the police working it out and then you segue into the attorneys and the DAs and all that stuff. But he always knew where there was going to be the twists. It's a triumph of formula over specific performances. But that being said, so many terrific performances.
So who is your favorite prosecutorial team?
Favorite Law and Order District Attorney prosecutorial team.
My favorite DA pairing was Michael Moriarty and Jill Hennessy. That would be Ben and Claire.
Wow, okay.
Yes, and they good only combo. Lasted one season. They only lasted one season, but the erotic heat was palpable.
Really?
But no, I have to say, Moriarty was always my favorite DA. I love Sam Waterston. Love him, love him, love him. But Moriarty will, you know, he actually is a remarkably subtle actor and manages, you know, when you're dealing with a show that is a triumph of formula, he manages to imbue everything with a reality and character that is remarkable. You know, a lot of the time when you're doing procedurals, you're just laying pipe. You know, as an actor, you got to get a certain amount of information out in a scene. And that's just that. That's, you know, these things are built like a machine and they don't function if something is missing. And so you don't get to have fun with it like you would with something that was a lot looser. But what I admired about Michael Moriarty was that he could still make it really interesting even when he's just laying pipe. And that's incredible.
Who is your favorite detective team?
Favorite Law and Order detective team.
Oh, my favorite detective team is, I'm going to go old school, Briscoe Logan. They had a longer run. See, as I said, Moriarty and Hennessy only had one season when they were together.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was Sam Waterston. And I just bought out emotionally. no, that's not true. I still love this.
So you don't think that Ben Stone is a goody-goody?
I liked that he was a goody-goody. Yeah. I think I'm a goody-goody. What are you saying? What are you saying,
Rebecca? I'm not saying anything. I just was posing a question. That's all. I'm posing a very Jack-like question rather than a Ben Stone-like question. He would never ask that question.
So I sensed a certain disdain in the way that you said that.
No, I think that Ben Stone, I love Ben Stone. I love Michael Moriarty in this show. His optimism for me, I don't know, a little bit much.
You were sickened by it. Especially, you are a cynic.
Yeah.
And you are
little bit.
A deeply angry woman, and that's fine.
A little bit.
I wanted to take a quick break to tell you about something I'm going to be doing. It's called Walk a Mile in Her Shoes. I'm going to go on a walkathon, but I'm going to be wearing high heel shoes. And yes, it's going to look as bad as you probably think it will. But this is a fundraiser for a crisis center near our home. And I want to do it because not only is it a good way to raise money for people who need it right now, but it is a time for me and other men to reflect about walking a mile in a woman's shoes. Now, even though one in four men will become a victim of emotional or sexual or domestic violence in their lifetime, men don't live with the specter of domestic violence the same way women do. A lot of times women don't have the same kind of options for getting help, getting out of a bad situation. So not only would I like you all to think a little bit about that, if you can, donate a little bit to my walkathon. Just go to lawandorderpodcast.com. There's a link. Just a couple of bucks would be great. It will help victims living near Rebecca and I. If you can't do that, pick some place close to you and lend a hand any way that you can. Again, if you want to donate a little something to my Walk a Mile in Her Shoes, just go to lawandorderpodcast.com.
It was a trip back in time to watch that episode. First of all, well, it shouldn't have been given the number of Donald Trump references.
No,
that's true. Why don't we get into looking at that? This is the first part of our two-part episode, The Torrents of Greed. Here's the summary. We first see gritty 1990 New York City and two cops waiting to buy lotto tickets from their favorite shop owner. The jackpot is $28 million, which is exactly the amount John Cryer got paid for playing Lenny in Superman 4.
Coincidence? I think not.
The shop owner is beat up and Greavy and Logan uncover a bootleg cigarette ring, which leads to the brother-in-law of a mob boss and eventually to the Don himself, Frank Masucci. In addition to his racketeering, Masucci is suspected of making a union boss take an extra long lunch break, if you know what I mean. And this is the part where I put my finger on my nose and bend it for some reason. Despite having a solid case against the underlings, Stone makes deals with these low-level mobsters to nail the Don. But surprisingly, these organized crime figures cannot be trusted. They set up Stone and intentionally get caught lying on the stand, thus torpedoing the state's case, and everybody goes free. But Stone swears he'll get Masucci. Oh, yes, he will get Masucci. Now, it strikes me as, like, about this is that how conspicuously dirty New York is. There's graffiti on the walls, and you see the morning's garbage bags on the sidewalk. Are they setting a mood, or are they actually just capturing a moment in New York history?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, they are capturing a moment. You know, they talk about Greenwich Village, you know, and how awful it is. Like, what does he say? Like, you tell me. Funny, right? Like, Greenwich Village right now, super gentrified place where, like, a lot of celebrities live. Yes or no, John Cryer?
No, it was different. New York was filthy. That is my big problem with a lot of movies that were shot in Los Angeles for New York.
Or
you
Vancouver.
Know, a lot of things, yes, a lot of things that were shot on location on a studio lot. Generally, they didn't make New York dirty enough.
Right.
And NYPD Blue was one of the first shows that they occasionally shot New York stuff, but they also shot studio stuff. And they would make a real effort. And I remember, I think that was on the Fox lot. And I remember going by and seeing them dirtying up the street. And I was like, oh, I feel like I'm home.
It smells like urine.
Yes, exactly. New York was, 90s was the beginning of the Giuliani era. And New York was just starting to gentrify at that point. So
it's also the end of the 80s, which means something if you're a New Yorker there, which is a, sort of coming out of that period where there was the bankruptcy and whole areas of the city were just sort of left abandoned. And it's kind of like Detroit today.
Right. Actually, my one like little quibble with the beginning of the setup is that the witness, who's the homeless guy, whose name is hilariously Edgar Hoover, he looks very clean. Like, he's got like a decent teeth. He's not so bad looking. And he's able to draw the correlation, you know, between the guy he sees beating up the shop owner. He says he's mean looking. He's got a fancy suit.
Mean looking fancy suit. Like Donald Trump.
Just like Donald Trump.
Yeah. Yes, there's two Donald Trump references.
The guy was wearing a suit, remember? Donald Trump?
It's like, oh, God, I was looking for a trip back in time. I was looking for some blessed relief from what was going on in the world when I was watching these shows, and I did not get it.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
But, John, as a fellow New Yorker born and bred, don't you feel like you've known Donald Trump your whole life? And this is just proof that we have, in fact, known Donald Trump our whole lives.
Yes. And it is frustrating for me, but partially because I feel like the apprentice version of Donald Trump is what America has seen. But I grew up with the other Donald Trump, the guy who, you know, was in favor of executing five innocent young boys who were framed for a rape. You know, that's the guy I have affection for.
That's Uncle Donald.
I remember.
It's so nostalgic.
So for me, it's, I'm saddened that the United States and maybe at some point the world will be living New York's nightmare from the 80s and 90s. But there are times when I see people, you know, who are, you know, wearing their Make America Great hats. And I just want to grab them and say, oh, I wish you'd been in New York in the 80s and 90s. You might change your mind, but whatever.
Yeah, well, we're going to cut all that out because half of our listeners are in the basket
of
deplorables.
Okay, great.
So going back to season one, it's clear that the pacing of this show is completely different than the move it along format that became the Law and Order trademark. Rebecca, agree or disagree?
100% agree. I mean, there was these like very sort of lugubrious conversations in the squad room, which, by the way, are stunning because Kragen is in this era of Law and Order. And Kragen is in the modern era of SVU, of course, no longer, but he was up until pretty recently. And it's like a different guy. I know the dialogue is different. By the way, he looks exactly the same. The man doesn't
age. Yes, he does. It's amazing.
Really, he doesn't. He's like the Benjamin Button of of the Law and Order universe.
He could have been born old, though.
But even just the way that he delivers his dialogue, it's just extremely different. It's a little snappier.
Fine, great. Be my guest. But when the wheel stops, my guess is we're going to be right back where we were yesterday. A witness who on a great day belongs in a rubber room. In other words, we got zip up because zero. What?
But the scenes are just a little bit, I don't know, it sort of has
he's
like
a He's kind of
more,
a different character.
He's a completely
different
character.
Than an SVU, where completely he's really
different.
Take charge. He's a little more.
The thoughtfulness is absent. It's just the business of policing. That's kind of what it struck me as opposed to these sort of very drama-laden scenes we see now. But also that they sort of took their time and kind of like relaxed a little bit in the squad room, although the phone calls are just as short as they are in modern-day Law and Order.
Well, it seems now that they're much more comfortable with their exposition. They're not hitting it as hard, because they're sort of trusting that the audience will get it. Back then, like at one point, Noth does that. He's in the import-export business, you know, meaning that he's in the mafia, which is like the nose pushed aside as you were doing, Kevin. Obviously, he felt like he had to hit it hard as an actor because he's practically leering into the camera.
Right.
But now they move it along faster, assuming that you get it. You know?
Yeah. Now, we have Kragen, and we've seen Logan before. A lot of people don't remember Max Greevy, George Zunza's character.
George Zunza, yes. Yeah. He seemed a little uncomfortable with the enormous amounts of exposition, to me.
But so jolly in his giant, giant old-timey computer, and he was like, I love this job. There's never been a jollier detective in the Law and Order universe.
He's the Santa Claus of Law and Order.
He's a teddy bear. Like when later in the episodes, when he's like roughing the guy up or like just does a hint, it's like, what, are you going to hug the guy? I mean, he doesn't really seem like the kind of person who would rough anyone up.
Also, his lovely attitude towards sexual harassment is really great because when they're in the elevator together and Noth's character is making oddly sexualized overtones at the woman who's standing next to him.
Come here, Rolf.
Close-throat cowboy leather bores me.
Nice line, bitch.
And then he refers to her as bitch and then laughs it off. Yeah. I love that Zunza is like, ha ha, that's hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
In this episode, we have a Hey, It's That Guy.
Hey, it's that guy.
Do you recognize Harve Beagle?
Harve Beagle?
Oh, he's a Hey, It's That Guy. And the only thing I recognize him from is He's on, I want to say he was like in like some movie like in the night. Was it like Regarding Henry that he was in?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do remember that. But I also know that he's been something that we've watched recently, and I'm not sure what it was.
This is actor Bruce Altman, and you probably remember him from Mr. Robot.
That's it. That was it.
And he has also been on each Law & Order and has a recurring role in Original Recipe as defense attorney Brad Feldman. Another guy, we see this all the time. We go, oh, I could just place him. John, I bet when you watch, you kind of go, hey, I know him. I worked on something with him.
Something with that guy, yes.
Yeah. It's not just it's that guy. It's, Craft Services. He was like,
it's that guy actually
he took the last of the soup. Yeah.
It's that guy actually
I had that with Hai Anzel, who's on the show, who's plays the owner of the guy who's buying the cigarettes.
Really?
Yes. That's Hai Anzel actually was on an episode of Two and a Half Men with me.
Huh.
He's known for his imitation of Cary Grant speaking Yiddish.
Wow.
It's have him on the show. It's totally worth it.
Now, the smartest thing I think that they did for the audience was to explain this conspiracy to Stone by literally drawing it out in chalk on a chalkboard.
Now, Pulaski swears he knows nothing about the cigarettes. He did, however, admit he was just doing a favor for his old friend, Beagle.
So Beagle is an accomplice to assault.
It gets better.
Mr. Zalter says he's too shishy to associate with riffraff like Pulaski, but it just so happens he has several truckloads of stolen cigarettes in his warehouse.
Guess who owns the warehouse?
Beagle.
So even if Zalter and Pulaski are telling the truth,
the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing.
But they're washing each other, so it's a conspiracy, gentlemen. They could all go away for a long time.
It was like an episode of The Wire. I had no idea what was going on, and it wasn't because it was so much sort of above me. It was mostly because so much of the dialogue was things like Kragen saying, we've got zip, bupkis, zero. So yeah, drawing it on the board actually was actually helpful.
Helpful, yes, in this context. Well, yeah, I had a hard time, too, getting between the mafiosos and the union guys. It was a little diffuse for me. I have affection for this episode, but I now see the problems. You know, it was one of those things that you remember as a kid. Well, but now you go, ah.
One of my favorite cues was when they were talking to the loading guy outside of Beagle's building, like the stock boy. And he's eating a hot dog while he's talking to the cops. Which, of course, someone's always doing something else when talking to the cops. But he's basically like,
look, man, you know how hard it is to get work? I keep my eyes closed. I keep my job.
What about your ears?
Sure. I hear stuff.
What kind of stuff?
Like guys that talk don't talk for very long. Look, I've seen Godfather 1, 2, and 3.
I've seen Godfather 1, 2, and 3. And it's like, oh, cue for the audience. This is about the mob.
So was anyone surprised when the mobsters outsmarted our hero Stone and Robinette?
I was surprised at the way. I did think, oh, gosh, it's Double Jeopardy. Oh, crap. That I did not see coming. So that they were outsmarted did not surprise me, and that I knew it was a two-episode arc helped. I'll be honest, I did not see the way that they were going to do it.
The Dandy Don, you mean, versus the Dapper Don? Is that...
Yes.
Do you know who Dandy Don was, right?
There was a real Dandy Don as well?
Yeah. Dandy Don Meredith, the football player and Monday Night Football announcer.
Right, but they were talking about John Gotti, the Dapper Don, when they
called
him
Dandy Don. I know, but isn't that clever they called him the Dandy Don?
I guess it's clever, I guess.
God,
I don't know.
Rebecca.
Anyway, I did not see the screwing Ben Stone coming. I mean, Beagle's lawyer tried really, really hard to sort of sweet talk Ben into not, you know, offering Beagle up, you know, and I don't know. It did surprise me, and the way that it came down also really surprised me.
Rebecca, you like stories that are ripped from the headlines, right?
You know it.
How about stuff that's ripped from headlines from decades ago? Stories that are great, but you've never heard of.
Like old-timey undiscovered stories?
Yes, exactly. There's a new podcast with all of that. It's called Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories, and it combines all of the information that you'd get in a modern-day true crime podcast. However, it's dramatized like old-time radio theater.
Wow.
And there are great cases that even Law & Order have drawn inspiration from. They tackle the Black Dahlia case, the murder of Bugsy Siegel, other stuff like that, too.
That sounds like a pretty cool idea for a podcast.
Yeah, and with each case ends, the host will tell you who they think committed the crime.
All right, so visit iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast directory and search for Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. Again, that's Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. Or visit Parcast.com/unsolved to start listening now. That's Parcast, P-A-R-C-A-S-T.com/unsolved to listen now.
Now let's look at the second episode in this two-part series. We pick it up with Stone and the cops holding a grudge for getting played. They get a wiretap on Masucci's phone and zero in on the Don's brother-in-law, Harvey Beagle. The detectives learn Beagle's been paying off a building inspector to ignore code violations at his rundown slums, including one which might have been John Cryer's first apartment. They charge Beagle with bribery, which they spin into a RICO charge, hoping he'll turn against his mobbed-up brother-in-law. Now, after an overly complicated plot to pressure the Don, Greavy and Logan learn the way it works as Masucci gives the orders and Beagle calls the hitman. And the surveillance team sees Beagle meet with the hitman, but then he disappears. Beagle's wife tells them where her brother literally has all the bodies buried. Surprise alert, it's New Jersey.
Surprise!
Masucci is arraigned, but his sister puts up the $1 million to bail him out, even though he had her husband killed. When we next see the dandy Don go to his favorite restaurant, he gets rubbed out like Pee Wee Herman in a movie theater.
That was so complicated. Like, no, every episode of the show you've been able to explain in like three sentences. You did a good job explaining it. I'm not saying you didn't. But this was complicated. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And the that is, a part and parcel of the original. I think the show was meant to have a documentary grittiness to it.
This episode or that show?
I think the first season of Law and Order when it was originally envisioned.
Yeah.
But I think once they realized that the structure worked so well, they realized that they could move it along just as a plot, the story's plot-wise. And I think that took some of the sort of grittiness out of it and gave it some more momentum, which is nice. That is the Law and Order that we've come to know and love. But I think they were working it out that first season.
Well, this episode is unique in all of Law and Order history because it is the only one that doesn't start with the standard intro.
Right.
It's a completely different read. It goes, occasionally, the criminal justice system can be twisted and manipulated
by the very people it's meant to punish. This is one of those cases. What started as an assault on a Russian candy store owner mushroomed into an investigation of Manhattan's most powerful crime family. These are some of the players.
And then it goes on and on. Our son was watching the episode with us, and he was like, this is like one of those things people are translating for the blind. Like, it's just like 10 minutes into the episode, the voiceover guy is still like, that's Ben Stone. He's walking to work, drinking a coffee right now. It was so epically long, that voiceover. It was crazy.
You really could have just watched episode two and picked up right where you left off.
Yeah.
My favorite scene is in the car where Logan is talking about the girl with the Geico and the cockroaches.
The gecko.
Oh, the gecko. Yes. Geico something else, right?
Yes, completely.
Free plug. So the girl with the gecko and the cockroaches.
I wake up to the sound of barking.
This one has a dog?
I wish. I ask her what's going on. She says cockroaches.
Cockroaches that bark?
That's what I said. She says the exterminator was a bust, so she bought a gecko. It's a lizard. It's some kind of Gila monster from Brazil or something.
And it eats roaches?
Down to the last drop. Barks when it's hungry.
And again, this just seems like it's another snapshot of New York 1990. Like, you would not hear that on SVU today, right?
No, because they're a machine on SVU now. You know, they're moving on to the next plot point. They're not just sitting around gabbing a moment and giving you a snapshot. They don't do that anymore. You can see that the show was envisioned as something a little bit different than what it ended up becoming.
But what really struck me about that whole conversation wasn't the cockroach and the gecko part. It was Logan bragging about his like sexual conquests in the car. And you're right. That is not something that we see anymore. Like the exposition, the sort of personal stuff, and even though SVU is so laden with personal stories, the exposition between characters is as quick as like a wink and a nod and then boom, done. And that was really a protracted little scene. And then there was all that stuff with the woman doing the wiretap, that other cop team who was awesome. That exposition was also great.
They kept betting on what people are going to order to eat.
Yes, it was great.
This is madness. It's crazy. And by the way, that cockroaches aren't what you think of when you think of New York City is amazing to me.
I know, me too.
They're the wildlife. They are the fauna. You know, there's
cockroaches and rats.
The flora is those tiny little trees that are fighting through the cracks in the sidewalks. And the fauna is cockroaches. And now they fly, by the way, because the palmetto bugs have migrated up from Florida. So you have these things we used to call water bugs, which are huge cockroaches that fly. I was going to say that f-ing fly.
You could say that.
Myself. Yeah. I can say that on this podcast?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Yeah. This okay. is a podcast.
Come on, John Pryor, swear.
F-ing fly.
Yeah.
Hey, this
and
is...
And it is so unnerving.
So did you ever have a bearded gecko when you were living in New York?
I did not.
A barking gecko? It was a barking gecko.
Barking gecko.
A bearded gecko sounds like something filthy.
You're thinking of the bearded dragon.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. That's right.
That's a sex move. I'm doing
that's right.
Move.
We also see
bitch.
Some...
Sorry, that really threw me.
Holster
cowboy. I just love that he laughed it off, you know?
Leather bores me.
We also get to see someone before they were famous.
Before they were famous.
Christine Baranski.
Yes.
Plays Masucci's sister and Beagle's wife. Of course, Christine got her big break as Trixie Fontaine in Speed Racer 10.
No, she did not.
Actually, her breakout role was the bitchy friend Marianne and Sybil, and as Diane Lockhart on The Good Wife, also starring whom?
Chris Noth.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
John, did you guys share a parking space at CBS, or were you in the same parking lot or anything like that?
With Baranski?
Yeah, you ever see her?
I have seen her a few times. She actually came to the pilot shoot of Two and a Half Men, because Chuck Lorre actually produced Sybil. And it was lovely to see her. It was a huge gesture of support. She's in the audience. It's like, oh my God, there's Christy Baranski. She was on Law and Order that first season. That's not how I remember.
What's
her.
So funny is that, you know, when I was watching these episodes, I just kept, even though she was Mrs. Beagle or whatever her name was, like, I just think of her as Baranski. And I'm like, oh, the Baranski says this, Baranski says that. And the thing about this TV appearance by Christine Baranski, obviously, I mean, she was a stage actress before, right, John? And it's, don't you think it's obvious in this episode that she was a stage actress before? A lot of those stage actor affectations, like she's like
smoldering looks,
the icy demeanor.
You know what you're doing, Mr. Stone?
Yes, Mrs. Beagle, I am attempting to put your brother in prison.
By getting my husband killed? Because that's what you're setting in motion.
Sort of line delivery that doesn't exist like among seasoned television actors, which now she clearly is, was all present in this episode.
Did you have habits like that, John, that you had to shake when you went from Broadway to film?
Yes, you project a little too much, you know, you enunciate probably more than you have to. But, you know, what's funny is when you're shooting stuff, it seems like it's supposed to be more real, but actually there's more on stage. You at least get the continuity of doing a scene.
Mm-hmm.
When you're shooting, the hard part is you've actually got a much more constrained parameters of doing things. Like you have to hit a very specific mark because otherwise the lighting's totally screwed and the focus puller can't focus on your face. And they expect much more realism. But oddly, being on stage is a much more realistic scenario.
Right.
One more cameo of note in the role of arraignment judge Kleinman. It's David Cryer.
What?
Who's that guy?
That's the father of John Cryer.
What?
Your dad was on this episode.
In the pivotal role of arraignment judge. because had he not arraigned them in that fashion, the whole thing would have fell apart.
That's enough, Mr. LeClaire. Bail is set at $100,000, cash or bond.
Now, is it true your dad left Harvard Law to play Curly in Oklahoma at the Polka Dot Playhouse in Bridgeport, Connecticut?
Yes, 100% true. Those are the kind of life choices that informed my my life. No, that's not true. He actually went to divinity school, though, at Yale Divinity School. So there.
Ah.
Fancy man.
Are you telling me the internet's wrong about that?
I think the internet is wrong about that.
But your father was in Broadway musicals, and he was also a regular on As the World Turns.
Yes, As the World Twirls.
My favorite soap of all time.
He was an organized crime boss on that show.
Oh. You know, because I thought it was kind of funny the way the camera swung and framed him up to do that line.
The one line.
It seemed very conspicuous. It was kind of like when Larry Flint played the judge that sentenced Larry Flint in The People versus Larry Flint. It was like, you're supposed to know who this is. And I guess if you had been a soap opera fan, you would have been like, hey, it's that guy.
Right.
It would have been a little loaded. Like, whoa, things are going to pop now.
As the World Turns, another New York-based soap. And obviously, it's no longer on the air. As the World Turns, by the way, was a kick-ass soap. It was a great, well-written soap with lots of great great actors, many of whom also populate the Law and Order universe, like Tamara Tooney, who plays the ME on SVU for many, 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 many years.
Yeah.
The ME on SVU ASAP.
Exactly.
Yes. Tamara, by the way, is an old friend of my mom's. My mom is an actress as well. But yes, thank goodness for the Law and Order franchises and soap operas, because they were the gainful employment for generations of New York actors.
Did you ever like turn on like your dad's soap and like see him getting it on with the maid and be like really confused or nothing like that happened?
He did not do a lot of getting it on that show that I recall. I didn't watch a lot of soaps at that time when he was on. I got into them later. Like, my favorite was during the writer's strike, because then they had to let the PAs write the shows. And there was this wonderful period where shit got crazy on all the soaps because none of them had paid writers. It was great. So that's when I got into them. But I think my dad had already moved on to doing, like, a Vita or something.
Give your dad a letter grade for his performance in this episode of Law and Order.
I'll give him an A-. You know, he had about four lines. He moved it along. He arranged them properly.
I think there was a very firm gavel. A very weak gavel, yeah.
But no, I love my dad. I can't
he
be
can't be critical.
Unbiased about this. I love my dad.
Of course you do.
What's funny is he tends to get parts that are kind of stoic and serious. That's just, you know, what he's been cast at. And, of course, he's hilarious.
Uh-huh.
So I don't get why that is, but that's been his bread and butter for a while. And the man can sing. Oh, my God. Absolutely beautiful singer. And he's still actually singing with the New Jersey Choral Society.
And he was in Evita? Is that what you said?
He was in Evita on Broadway for a long time. Took over for Bob Gunton after he left. I actually spent a lot of time backstage at Evita as a kid, and it was great. He was in 1776. He did a lot of shows.
He was obviously underutilized in this episode
really
of Law and Order.
Yes.
The singing judge? I mean, that would have been epic.
That's like
not only are you merely jailed, you're really most sincerely jailed. Okay. So let's go back to the episode. They finally go and find the bodies in New Jersey, which, again, I'm sure the Chamber of Commerce loved that scene. By the way, nice job, crime guys, preserving the scene.
What, reaching into the ground and pulling the body out?
Digging with their hands.
There were so many funny, weird, like, moments like that in this show, like when they were looking at the footage in the prison of the closed circuit security footage, and there was like a pan shot across the yard.
Yes, it was beautifully shot. It was like Martin Scorsese.
I know. Who's in that tower running that camera?
So many weird little things that definitely took you out of the texture, like details that I don't think they let fall to the wayside these days now that the show is super polished. And on one hand, this is much grittier. On the other hand, it's just not as well produced as like the modern TV.
And John, with all of your experience now on Addendum and your fascination with all things true crime, you must have been looking at those cops digging the body out with their bare hands going, way to screw that investigation.
Yes, yeah, it was. I was like, that's going to help in court.
Put the hat on him again. Yeah, that was a good call. Yeah,
it's all I can do not to watch Law and Order and go, Brady violation.
Well, we also got Rico in this episode, which was fun. And we got the Giuliani reference without saying the name. What was it, our new favorite state's attorney?
U.S. District Attorney.
Rico is his favorite crime. That was Giuliani they were talking about, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's all these little like moments like that. But yeah, sticking the arms into the ground, pulling the body out by the underarms, not necessarily the best way to preserve a crime scene.
Now, this episode is called The Torrents of Greed. And greed is a recurring theme. You've got greedy gangsters, greedy civil servants, greedy limo drivers, greedy jailhouse informants. Even Stone gets greedy, ignoring the low-level guys trying to nail the big boss.
That's right.
So doesn't greed do everybody in this episode?
Yes, now that you mention it, I'm so embarrassed. I didn't notice that. I was like, wow, okay. You blew my mind, Kevin.
Does it do Baranski in, though? It doesn't do Baranski in. She ends up fine, just kind of fine at the end, right?
Oh, you're right.
Oh,
but
yeah.
She gave $1 million away.
No, she got it back.
Oh, yeah, when he's dead.
Yeah. They say now that he's dead, she'll get the bail money back.
You're right.
Yeah,
greed
yeah.
Pays. That totally controverts the whole message.
Yeah, I guess that greed is good.
Yeah.
That was a whole other movie, right?
Yeah.
Let's take a look at the real life story that inspired this episode. It's now time for Rip from the Headlines.
You think you know who did it?
You think you know who did it?
But you don't know who. This episode was inspired by the life of feared mafioso John Gotti. He was the most violent member of New York's Gambino crime family. Gotti feared the boss, Paul Castellano, was going to have him whacked. So Gotti struck first. In 1985, he had Castellano knocked off as he walked into his favorite restaurant. Gotti took over the Gambinos, sparking a mob war among the other New York families. In public, Gotti was always chipper with the press, giving them brilliant quotes. They dubbed him the Dapper Don, always sharply dressed in an expensive camel hair coat. The FBI was not as enamored with him. Gotti was arrested, tried, and acquitted three separate times, thanks to jury tampering and witness intimidation. The press gave him a new nickname, the Teflon Don, because nothing could stick to him. More than a year after this episode aired, Gotti was finally convicted on murder and racketeering charges when Sammy, the Bull, Gravano turned state's witness. His arrest led to the downfall in prominence of the Italian mob in New York. John Gotti died in prison from throat cancer in 2002.
So this episode is not subtle in making a fictionalized version of John Gotti. I didn't have to grow up in New York to know, hey, that's John Gotti.
Well, yeah. It was also just the shoulder pads. Just the 80s shoulder pads were the total giveaway.
They were, as was the big Tudor-style home in Queens, which is very similar, by the way, to the compound on which John Gotti resided. I know this, being a Long Islander. Like, photos of John Gotti's family compound were on the news all the time when I was growing up. This stuff, for me, is like canon for my teens.
But, John, you know, for those of us who didn't grow up in New York City or live in New York City in the 80s and 90s, it's hard to believe the press really made a celebrity out of a guy that everybody knew to be a violent criminal. Was he, like, really a tabloid hero?
He was beloved. In Brooklyn, he used to do a huge fireworks show, completely illegal fireworks show. And it's not like the cops could ignore it and not notice that there's literally fireworks going off. But he was beloved. New York is an interesting cultural mélange. Mm. Yes, I said that.
You've been dying to say that.
You know, there's a certain affection for its underside, even among the people who suffer from it. It's very strange. Some people like the more colorful aspects of its history. One of the things that was a rational expectation at that time that is no longer, partially thanks to Giuliani, was you expected an enormous amount of corruption. You expected it if you had a business, if you were going to be dealing with anything, if you were going to try to get anything done with the city government, there was going to be corruption. That was just, you know, that was how everybody felt. So you felt like he was a guy who was just taking advantage of it. You know, that's one of the reasons that another Teflon Don, Donald Trump, has been, you know, sort of immune to a lot of the scandals that surround him, is people sort of expect that if you're going to become a billionaire, you got to break some eggs.
Grease the skids.
To paraphrase
the
Stalin.
Joker. Now, when this episode aired, Gotti was a free man. How crazy is that when you look back?
Oh, there was stuff about him in pop culture all the time. To me, it's
all
not
time,
crazy
yeah.
at all. Yeah, he was definitely like, he would make appearances. He was a personality. Like, John Gotti would show up to these Columbus Day parades. Like, that, he was a personality, right, John?
Oh, absolutely. If you would go to a restaurant, you'd see the pictures of the celebs on the wall. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there's John Gotti.
Sardi's, John Gotti.
Absolutely. Yes. It was absolutely true.
Just, they were mobsters.
They were mobsters.
They were mobsters.
Right, basically. But you know what?
They were killing people.
Kind of looking at, like, the Whitey Bulger persona. By the way, and I never heard of Whitey Bulger ever growing up. I heard of Whitey Bulger, like, 15 years ago when I started seeing news reports about the search for him. But the New York
reporters
mobsters
didn't follow Whitey Bulger around at dinner time and
exactly.
ask him. But in New York, I just find that as like a quintessential and only a New York thing. In L.A. or Chicago, I don't see that happening.
That's also where the media lives, is in New York. We know that. We like we know when there's like a horrible storm that happens in New York, it's going to get a hell of a lot of play on the Today Show.
Yeah.
We know that.
10 billion people get wiped out in a hurricane and it comes after Brangelina.
The media eyes and ears of America are still New York and Los Angeles. There are moments where I remember during the height of the Britney Spears craziness, when there was like three helicopters hovering at night over my neighborhood in Studio City. And I was like, oh my gosh, I guess we're in the center of the world, you know, you know, because there's three helicopters trying to see where Britney Spears is going to the drugstore.
Were you positive they weren't there for you?
Well, not 100%.
Not He's positive. A goody-goody. We know he wasn't there.
They're waiting to get something on you. Hey, that's going to do it for us. I want to thank you to our special guest, John Cryer. John, where can listeners follow you online if they want to harass you?
I am only on the Twitter. I am on at Mr. John Cryer. I don't do Facebook. If you see me on Facebook, it's a liar.
it's those Russian hackers.
Yes, Snapchat, that ain't me. Instagram, there is me, but I'm so boring on Instagram. I have like a picture of my backyard. So don't even bother on Instagram.
And Rebecca, how can our listeners follow you?
They can follow me at Reb Lavoy. I'm the one obsessively tweeting to John Cryer all the time. And they can also follow me at Reb Lavoy on Instagram.
And you can track me on Twitter at Kevin P. Flynn. You can also tweet at us at Law & Order Pod. Our newsreader is Cy Frater. Our theme music was composed and performed by Uncanny Valleys. If you enjoyed this podcast, leave a review on iTunes. It helps others discover this program just like you did. All clips in this podcast were used in compliance with U.S. Copyrights Act Fair Use Exemption for criticism and commentary. Special thanks to the elite squad of the Law & Order Wiki community for preserving the evidence. If you want to see what episodes we'll be talking about, go to lawandorderpodcast.com, then check your local listings. We'll see you in 2 weeks. These Are Their Stories was recorded in Studio C and is a production of Partners in Crime Media.
Partners in Crime Media.
Do you like true crime or mystery podcasts, movies, and TV shows? Check out Unsolved Murders, True Crime Stories. With the help of an ensemble cast of voice actors, follow hosts Wendy and Carter as they take you on an entertaining journey through real crime scenes and attempt to solve the case. Listen now on your favorite podcast directory or app, or by visiting parcast.com/unsolved. That's spelled P-A-R-C-A-S-T.com/unsolved.